Tonight on A Special World Over, we pay tribute to two greats, the legendary Washington journalist and columnist Robert Novak, an iconic comedian, actor, director, and philanthropist Jerry Lewis. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. If you'd like to comment on tonight's show, and I hope you'll watch the whole thing, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. Let's get started. 15 years ago this week, one of the great legends of political journalism, the famed reporter Robert Novak, passed away at the age of 78. His nickname was the Prince of Darkness, earned in the 1950s due to his somewhat pessimistic and sardonic view of D.C. politics. I spoke with him many times on this show about his life, his syndicated column, his conversion, and, of course, his work on television, Evans and Novak and Capital Gang, Crossfire, and the numerous U.S. presidents he covered over his long career. Bob was also a friend, an early mentor, and a boss of mine. I worked for he and his partner, Roland Evans, at Evans and Novak when they were writing the column. Long before the internet, I was the guy who would go out and search through the morgue for the articles or to confirm a piece of the column here or there. They taught me a lot about chasing down sources, sourcing a story properly, and what journalism really achieved. He was truly one of the greats and is sorely missed, particularly during the mayhem of this presidential season. Here are some highlights of interviews I conducted with the great Robert Novak.
Bob, what a fantastic book, The Prince of Darkness, 50 years reporting in Washington, D.C.
Thank you.
I want to start with your view of what you do each day. You consider this a public service to the country.
Oh, I don't know about that. I'm a private citizen. So I don't have any responsibilities to the government, just to my God and my family and myself. What I do each day is I try to learn what's happening on interesting subjects and in important subjects. I try to find out things that are not available to the ordinary public, that are not that are hidden from view. And that's what I think an investigator, a reporter's investigative function is, to really reveal things that the politicians and the governing class don't want you to know.
In the book, you say something. You say, I enjoy making life miserable for hypocritical, posturing politicians.
As most of them are.
And your column is read, we should tell those living outside the Beltway, this column is read voraciously in town, also across the country, but certainly in town. It's mandatory reading. And you always try to include, if memory serves, one new bit of information in every column.
Every column, yes. And that's so each day, as you say, what I do each day, I try to find that new information, try to look for it, probe for it, to kind of throw some lines out. And maybe some of the fish will bite.
And roil the waters.
That's right.
I want to look at your background. You really paint a fascinating picture of your entire childhood growing up. And I want to explore a bit how the seeds of that childhood really led you down this path of journalism that's been so illustrious and bared such incredible fruit all these years. Maurice and Jane Novak, what of your parents do you see in yourself?
Well, my father was a great interest in public affairs. He was a chemical engineer. My parents were both children of immigrants, Jewish immigrants, and he was very much interested in political life, public affairs, and I see a lot of that of me in him. He loved sports, and I like sports, and my mother wanted to know everything that was going on. I think she was a natural-born reporter, but she never was in journalism. So I see something of that now. They were people that most people love. A lot of people don't love me, so I don't take credit for my. I don't blame my abrasive personality on my parents.
Oh well, there are a lot of people who do love you, Bob. Let's not cut everybody out. You have in the book. You were called the little baby Jesus by family members.
I had a number of about a dozen female cousins. I was the only young boy cousin in an extended family, and I was an only child. And wow. So they thought my parents treated me like a little baby Jesus.
What was your religious training like?
We were nominally observant Jews. That is, we'd go to services on the high holidays, no time else. My grandfather, my father's father, had been a Russian immigrant. He'd been in the Russian Imperial Army. He was definitely a non-observing Jew, and none of his sons were bar mitzvah. My father was not, but I was bar mitzvah. My father wanted me to. That was about the end of my religious observance. I kind of drifted away from the Jewish religion after my bar mitzvah and never took it up again.
I want to talk later about your conversion, because it's an interesting, really fascinating evolution there. You started writing sports journalism, right?
That's right. All of my father and his brothers and my uncles and my mother said were all good athletes. I was not. So I ended up, instead of being an athlete, a sports writer. Started off writing. I was the manager of the track team in high school. I started writing stories about. I always knew I wanted to be a journalist. Why? Don't ask me. I knew. But I started writing sports stories, and all through high school, I was springing for the local paper. And then they had me coming in and working weekends. And then after I graduated from high school in the summer, where I learned all kinds of things besides sports. How to cover a police story, government. I even did home furnishings for a while. Wrote a lot of obituaries, that was my school of journalism.
And then you work for the AP, and you're covering kind of local politics, right?
I was covered after I was in the Army after college, and after 2 years in the Army, I covered the Nebraska legislature, the Indiana legislature, and then at the ripe old age of 26, I was lucky enough that they was transferred to Washington. Help cover Congress.
Did you want to come to Washington?
Oh, I can't tell you how I wanted to come to Washington. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven when I came to Washington. I was very lucky. I've had a combination. I work very hard and have a lot of good fortune, and I've always felt I've been blessed. At that time, it was very unusual for a 26-year-old kid to get transferred by the AP.
How has this town changed since you've been here, since you came here at 26?
Remarkably. It was a kind of a dowdy, slightly southern town. None of the posh New York-style restaurants, none of the fancy apartment buildings such as the one we're in right here. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit down at the heels. Pennsylvania Avenue was kind of slovenly. It looked different. It was different. And there was less money in the town. This is a big money town. It's like New York now.
Oh, yeah. Well, probably mostly owing to the lobbyist institution
exactly.
That's taken hold. Has that destroyed politics here in town? And what effect has it had on journalism, the money that sloshes around Washington?
I think it has changed politics. I think it's changed journalism tremendously. There's much less attempt of collegiality, of cordiality, of trying to get along, trying to reach settlements. There's a kind of a crudeness about it, and it's really changed journalism tremendously. I guess it's not a bad thing. Journalists get paid a lot more than they used to, but it's much more of a big business money game, much less simple than it used to be.
It's much more vicious personally,
it
too.
Is, it
and
is.
I mean, the amazing thing to me is now journalists have become the stories, or at times get drafted into the story, as you have written a book about. How good or bad is that for the information that the common man is receiving back home? What influence does it have?
I think it tends to distort the information. Doing the research for the book and on the event of my 50th anniversary of being in Washington, I was looking at some of the papers for 50 years ago, Washington Post, New York Times, and so on. And believe it or not, the stories were about what happened yesterday. You know, they weren't about analysis. They weren't about philosophizing. They weren't editorializing. They were just factual accounts of what happened yesterday. You don't have that today. Mm. And the people could make their own conclusions. Now we have an awful lot of analytical material. The journalists are much better educated than they were then, but I don't know if the public is getting as good a picture.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about Roland Evans. You were at the time at the Wall Street Journal, correct? He's at the Herald Tribune.
I had just come back from my honeymoon from Spain in 1962, and I have a message that he wants to get a hold of me, and I've been calling me every day, and I call him back. He wants to have lunch at a very low scale beef house, so nobody would see us there, you know. I've had a lot of surprises in my life, but that what he said, he was been offered to do a 6-day-a-week column syndicated by the New York Herald Tribune, but he couldn't do it himself. He needed a partner, and he wanted me as his partner. I had exchanged 10 words with him in my life. He was from a different social milieu. He was a friend of the Kennedys. He was a socialite.
Kind of patrician. I mean,
very patrician. Yeah, his family didn't come over on the Mayflower, but not much long after that. Naturally Episcopalian, yeah. Although originally they had been Quakers in Pennsylvania. But he knew me. I was surprised he even knew who I was.
Why do you think he chose you, Bob?
He thought I was a good reporter. Uh-huh. And we were going to do a reporting column that was higher on facts and less on opinion, 6 days a week. Had to work very hard to do it, and he thought I was a good reporter. Mm-hmm. So that was a great compliment, and we had a lot of negotiating to do, but that's what we did.
Well, and it was the beginning of an incredible institution that persists to this day, even in his absence. How did you work? Now, I remember, I worked for you for a time, and I can remember these loud voices as if we were down at a bar for sailors on the wharf. Everything but broken bottles we could hear behind those doors. What was happening in
there? We had a fight every day.
I know it.
And I used to say we fought about everything but money, but truth be told, sometimes we fought about money. It was not the usual fight. The usual fight was what was in the column, who was going to write what, how we were going to write it. Sometimes we'd fight over the word. Mm-hmm. And I said in the book that he was more of a brother than a friend. And as brothers sometimes have a strange relationship, a combative relationship. But we got the column out every day of the week.
How did you work? Tell me how you all worked together. Did all that friction, all that passion, all that argument, in some ways, didn't that add to the vivacity of the column?
It really did. And you knew when you wrote something, a lot of trouble with a lot of columns is they please themselves and they don't please anybody else and then nobody wants to print it. Mm. But I knew I had the sharpest, harshest critic I could find in Rolly Evans. Mm. And he had the harshest critic he could find in Bob Novak. And it was really an amalgam. What we would do is we'd start off in the morning and decide who had the best idea. And then that person would write the column. And then, we hoped he would get a first draft done by about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm. And the other person would get the column. And we had Art Buchwald used to be across the hall from us. And he said the way we did it is after the guy wrote that column, spent all day writing it, the other person would take it, cross it all out, and pencil in a new column. Well, that wasn't quite true, but not so far from the truth.
I love it. What did you learn from him, from working with Rolly and the way he worked?
I learned that you never give up in reporting a story. Yeah, he and many of, you know, he was, a lot of people thought he was a little white shoe society boy, and I was a tough guy from the Midwest. Mm-hmm. But he was in many ways a more tenacious reporter even than I was, and he never gave up on a story. Make that last phone call. Don't give up. And that was the lesson I got from him.
Mm. Do you miss him? Do you miss working with him?
Sure. I say in the book that after he retired after 30 years, and I said in many ways it was easier writing the column because it took about 2 hours of the time of preparation off the column, but I missed having him there as a critic.
You also did the eulogy at his funeral.
Yes, I did. That was very interesting that I was the only eulogist, and I was a long way from being his best friend, but I say I was like a brother. And all the friends he had from his the fancy people in Georgetown, the society circuit, and he picked me to do the eulogy.
Hmm. Let's talk for a moment about, you mentioned Karl Rove in the book, the president's counselor. And you say we had a symbiotic relationship built on self-interest, and that this is the rule of DC journalism. One of the things that I love about the book is it really gives people an insider's view of what happens here, how information is shared, and why. Is that good in the long run, that kind of relationship?
Well, it's the way it works, and it's the way I find out things. Mm-hmm. Did he tell me everything was happening in the administration? Of course not. Did I buy everything he was trying to sell to me? Of course not. But what he did do, he told me a lot of things. He got me away from things that were incorrect. He suggested ideas. And the symbiotic relationship was that I was getting information from him, and he was getting an appraisal that was friendly from me. Now, you say that's a kind of a corrupt relationship, but I don't think it is. I think it's the way journalists work. It's the way Bob Woodward works. It's the way, in the old days, Jack Anderson worked, Drew Pearson, and people who are not just sitting, sucking their thumb and saying, what do I think of this, but finding out what's really happening behind closed doors. That's the way they have to act. Mm-hmm.
One of the things I loved watching you work up close for the time I was in your office, and it's something I've been able to import, and a great lesson that I hope those who are practicing journalists or aspirants absorb this. It was amazing to me, you'd get a little bit of information at a luncheon, and you mention in the book, you say, nuggets of news often drop in an informal setting, and I love that, because it's true. The moment you bring the pen or one of these horrible cameras in, you're done. That's they won't right. tell you anything.
That's right.
But those informal things, you pick up those great nuggets, then you would work those phones all afternoon, calling every official, cross-checking them, not telling them where you got the information,
right.
and almost playing one against the other.
That's right. And sometimes, you call somebody up and you say, how you doing? You know, and you don't say what you want, and you say, how is this issue going? You couldn't care less about that issue. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, you lead them into the thing you really want to talk to them about, and that's the way it works.
And wham, they're in the Novak body slam, never to escape. Was there ever a golden age of bipartisanship? We keep hearing that, that everybody got along, Democrats and Republicans, and Tip O'Neill and Reagan sharing beers. Is that just a myth?
I think it's strictly exaggerated. In fact, it was really much more violent in the early days of the Republic. There was story I like to tell about Senator Sam Houston, who was a senator from Tennessee, and he was challenged to a duel by an opponent from the House, and walking on Sunday night in front of Boyer House on Pennsylvania Avenue, he saw the man who challenged him. He thought he was coming after him, so Sam pulled out a gun and shot him, see? And the guy lived. But so things are not that bad. We had a case, as you know, just as the Civil War was starting, before it started, where a senator was nearly beaten to death. By an emancipation senator from the Northeast was nearly beaten to death by a Southern House member with his cane on the floor of the Senate. We don't do that.
Not that bad. Yeah. But we do it using the media today, I think, more often than not, trying to disparage and kill people's reputations. Yes?
I think this is a period. I think there's ebbs and flows, and I think this is a period of less cordiality than there used to be. I was interviewed today by Joe Scarborough of MSNBC, used to be a congressman. Mm-hmm. And Joe came in with that big class of 94, and he told me that he never spent one weekend in Washington all the time he was in Congress. He was in Congress for several years. And that didn't surprise me at all. That is true. There's very little social life now among the congressmen and their families. They used to congressmen would have a family as guests of another, and they'd invite journalists and their families. But there is very little of that life in Washington now.
Mm-hmm, that culture's dead. Mm-hmm. What do you make of the personal attacks and smears? Larry Flint coming out and exposing sordid details of somebody's personal life. I mean, you were here during the Kennedy and the LBJ administration. Certainly there were skeletons that were known by the journalistic community. But those things were kind of not reported.
We didn't think they were. See, that we had much more access as reporters than most reporters have today. I have an incident in the book where I was covering Senator Ed Muskie when he was the front runner for the Democratic presidential nomination in 72, and he didn't like me much, but let me on his plane. He was flying from Milwaukee to Wausau, Wisconsin on a Sunday morning, and this will interest you, and he was in a rage because he hadn't been scheduled for Mass any time that day. And he was screaming. He had a violent temper, Muskie. You know, everybody thought he was the stoic New Englander. He had a violent temper. And he was screaming at the advance man how important it was for him to go to Mass. And I was not a Catholic. I thought it was pretty funny. But I didn't write a word of it. That's the point. Not one word. Today, that all would be written in a reporter. But I don't know if the reporter would be left on the plane. Hmm. Senator Obama, I am told, does not let any reporter on his SUV. He does not go on the reporter's bus. There's a big iron curtain between the newsmen and the press because they don't trust each other.
And that's a bad relationship, and certainly terrible for the people. You settle a few scores in this book, which I have to say I took some devilish pleasure in. Chris Matthews, tell me your relationship with Chris Matthews.
Chris Matthews and I were on crossfire. I had known Chris when he was an aide to Speaker O'Neill. Speaker O'Neill wrote in his memoirs a lie about me and Rowley. It was just an absolute lie, and that he had kicked us out of his office when we had virtually offered him a bribe. Just a canard. The book is full of lies. Mm. But I wrote about that, and Chris Matthews. We got into a little thing on Crossfire before he had his own program on MSNBC. And Chris kept saying I was there. He was giving the impression he was there at the time I was kicked off.
He witnessed you being thrown
and
out.
And he wasn't even on his staff when this alleged incident happened, which never happened. Huh. So that broke our relationship. And we see each other and we nod, but I don't speak to him.
You've never been on Hardball?
I was asked in the early years many times, but I told him to stop asking me because I never would go on.
What about John McLaughlin, an institution on television with his McLaughlin group?
Well, I was present at the creation of the McLaughlin group, as I tell in the book. He didn't know much about journalism. It's a miracle that he was able to put this together. But he got me as his first panelist, and he asked me a lot of advice. And I don't think I ever liked John very much, but we worked closely together. But once he got it settled, he got very arrogant And I left the program because I just couldn't stand him anymore and started the Capital Gang. I was the founder and co-executive producer of the Capital Gang on CNN.
Founding Capital Gang, founding Evans and Novak, you were executive producer of both of those programs. You were also on Crossfire for many years and present really at the founding of CNN as well.
I was the last person on the air the first weekend to still be on the payroll. I was the last of the Mohicans.
Huh. How did that happen? Relationship with CNN.
How did I got there?
Right.
Well, like most things in this business, it's who you know. Ed Turner was the executive vice president for news at the beginning of CNN, and he had been the news director of Channel 5 in Washington when it was the Metro Media Station, and he had given Rowley and me our first real television work as columnists doing political
Channel
commentary.
5.
Pardon?
On Channel 5.
On Channel 5 in 1966. And for a while we had a weekly interview program called the Evans and Novak program, which had a twist in it that Time magazine did a big story on that after the interview was over we'd comment on it.
Right.
And that was very unusual in those days. And so when Ed was taken on at CNN by Ted Turner, no relation. One of the first people who came to was asked us to go on the network.
What happened there at the end?
At the end, two things happened. The CNN was losing the ratings war to Fox, and they brought in some new management. They brought in a guy who was very well known in Hollywood named Jonathan Klein, not very well known in the news, and I didn't have to talk to him long, and I could see he didn't like politics. It was not in his bag, and so he canceled all the shows I was on, and I was still drawing the same payroll, mm-hmm. paycheck, but I'm not as dumb as I look, and when they cancel all of his shows you're on, you don't have much future with that.
you kind of know that this is played out.
Then the other thing is this. Valerie Plame affair came, and I could tell they did not like my association with it. They gave me, said they were, Mr. Klein told the interviewers that he was forming 100%, you know, like the baseball owners say that they're mm-hmm. they're for the manager. Mm-hmm. But by the time I finally left, and they said they weren't going to renew my contract when it came due, and I was very happy for that. I think the string had been run out. The thing that gave them the pretext to get rid of their conservative totem was a token. Was to I lost my temper when one night on one of the rare shows I had been on, and James Carville was taunting me, and and I stalked off the set with an expletive, and as I knew as I walked off, that gave them the out to get rid of me.
You know, we should ask right off the bat, why the Prince of Darkness? You know, people are going to think you've become a Satanist here.
You know, the pastor of my church at St. Patrick's here, when he heard the name of it, he wondered if they would have to do an exorcism with me. You know, but a young reporter from the when I was a young reporter with the Wall Street Journal, I'm 28 years old, covering the Senate, and a colleague from the Washington Post and I used to close up the Senate every night. We couldn't leave till they adjourned and drone through the final hours, and we have these long conversations about the fate of Western civilization and the political game. And I was so critical of the way government was and the political class that he said, you know, you really talk like the Prince of Darkness. And that word kind of spread around the press gallery, and a lot of people don't even know what the origins was. So a lot of people think it's because I am a conservative and I'm for limited government and low taxes and individual economic freedom, and that makes you the Prince of Darkness, I guess.
Tell us about that landmark book, Whitaker Chambers' book, Witness. What impact did that have on you?
I was a second lieutenant in the Army and during the Korean War, and I thought I was probably going to go to Korea, and I had considered myself a agnostic when I went into the Army, but I suddenly realized I might be killed, and I didn't want to pray not to go, but I wanted to pray that I would commend myself. I just started praying naturally that I would commend myself well, perform well if I went into combat. And right about that time, I read Witness by Whitaker Chambers, and President Truman had run the Korean War so badly. There was such anger. I was a second lieutenant, and there was such anger in the officer class about not having enough supplies and ammunition, not being able to do our thing, and in a static situation. And I wondered if this whole Cold War was phony. And Whitaker Chambers had a great impact on me in two ways. One, it indicated that the war against communism was something that was very important to our survival as a free country. And secondly, it was important because he really believed that all the world divided itself on those who were with God and against God. And I began to wonder, which side am I on? I'm certainly not against God, but am I with God? Not really, because I don't go to church, I don't have a religion. And so that set seeds that really didn't gestate for many years.
What I love between all the political machinations that you report and your insider view of all these major stories that you not only reported, but in some cases were a part of, there is this spiritual tug one feels from the very beginning of the book. And the Chambers incident is certainly coming across that book, Witness. And we should say Whitaker Chambers became he was a communist who then totally transformed his life and became a militant anti-communist.
And a man of God, too. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the book is beautifully, big, fat tome. I think you have it over there. But what I love about it is then we see you kind of drifting in and out, trying to find a spiritual home. Tell us a little about that. After your marriage to Geraldine, and what happens?
Well, we were married in a she was a Methodist and was not really practicing, and we were married in a Presbyterian church. I lived in Georgetown, and it was a preacher, and he gave us a kind of a non-Christian ceremony, if you know what I mean. It was very pretty and very nice, but not very Christian. Mm-hmm. And then we went to. We lived on Capitol Hill, and we went to an Episcopalian church for a while, but I didn't like it much. I was very uncomfortable with the liturgy, and I just thought all this religious mumbo-jumbo bothered me. But my wife started looking for a church. She felt a need after many, many years. Children were growing, really, and she was looking. She had become a pro-life activist, and it wasn't the religion sent her into the pro-life movement. The pro-life movement sent her looking for a church.
Really?
Yes.
And what impact did that have on you?
Well, she couldn't find any Protestant church that was pro-life. So we moved from the suburbs after the kids were out of college into this apartment where I am right today, downtown Washington, and she walked over to St. Patrick's Church. And that was the first church she said. She said, you know, would you like to go? I think this is one you would like. And, I really believe the Holy Spirit is at work, because it's hard to explain these mysteries. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I felt comfortable. Now, was it comfortable because suddenly I found one of the priests there was a man named Peter Voggy, who I had known as a Republican lawyer, a great political operative, a great news source of more of Rolly Evans than of me. Was it just that he made me more comfortable? Maybe that was part of the Holy Spirit. And at about the same time, my dear friend Jeff Bell, a Republican politician who was a Catholic convert, put, not at the same time, a little later, put me in touch with Father C. John McCluskey, who was an Opus Dei priest and a great proselytizer. And he started having breakfasts and lunches with me. And
These lunches went on, and breakfast, Bob, for 20 years.
That's right.
I mean, it wasn't like you were a quick hit here, Bob.
No.
This is a long... What did he say? I mean, how...
We talk about politics. He's a conservative. We talk about politics. We talk about how bad some of the politicians were. And very seldom would he on his own bring it up. And sometimes I'd ask him a question. And, you know, I said, I went to Mass the other day, and they said that the wafer was really the body of Christ. How can anybody believe that? You know, you have to believe that
to be a Catholic.
He said, "Yeah, you do." So it was a very soft sell, could we say? Sort of thing. And so there was two things happened, and then this went on for years. And then there was an event that I write about in the book
in Syracuse
University. I was giving a speech there, and the sponsoring group, the college Republicans, as they do before a lecture, they have the committee has a little dinner for you before, and there were all men and one young woman, and I noticed that she wore around her neck a crucifix, and I said, "Are you a Catholic?" And I don't know why I asked her that. It's I usually don't ask things like that, and I thought she said yes. As it turns out, I've later found, she said no, she was Greek Orthodox. But I thought she said yes, and then she said, "Are you a Catholic?" I said, "No, I said that my wife and I have been going to Mass for many years." And she said, "Are you going to convert?" I said, "No, we have no such plans." And she said, "Mr. Novak, life is short, but eternity is forever." And I got a chill up my back. I got a chill right now when I said it. I always get a chill when I think of that, and it was like the Holy Spirit was there. I could hardly sleep that night. And I came back to Washington the next morning. I told Geraldine, "I think I'm ready to be a Catholic." And I think she was ready, had been ready for a long time. The funny thing is, this woman, I didn't know her name. And when I started writing this book many years later, 10 years later, I found out that there was only one woman at that dinner. So I got my staff, my arch crack staff, found our... She's married with a child, and called her up, and she said, I sometimes wear a crucifix," she said, "but I'm not Catholic, so it couldn't have been me." And she said, "I might have said that," she said, "but I don't remember saying it." And so I was really in a quandary, and then she sent me an email of her picture with her husband and baby, and it was her. I will never forget her face.
Uh-huh.
It was the same woman. So I think that the Holy Spirit is working in the fact she didn't exactly remember it, and I remembered her saying something that she really didn't say.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Tell me about, you then convert. You come into the church at St. Patrick's here in Washington, D.C. You take the patron saint, St. Thomas More.
That's right.
Why?
Because I felt that he was an example of somebody who showed I often, when I give a commencement speech, somebody is foolish enough to have me as a commencement speaker, I tell the graduates, always love your country, but never trust your government. And I don't think politicians or governments are to be trusted. And certainly, Thomas More went to the block to have his head chopped off by Henry VIII because he would not submit to government. He was Chancellor of England. He wore the symbol of Paul around his neck, and underneath the ermine robes, he wore a hair shirt because he was a Christian ascetic, Catholic ascetic, and he wrote in Latin to Erasmus. They had a correspondence going, mm-hmm. and they talked about a national community of peace to do away with war. To do away with war in the 16th century. I mean, that was that's what all governments were for, was to make war. He was a truly great man. And, you know, people say, do you think you're Thomas More? No, I'm not Thomas More. They don't threaten me with shoving my head off, and I'm not a Chancellor of England, but he's an inspiration to me. And I write in three places. I write in a little office down the hall here in my mm-hmm. apartment. I write a place where my office downtown, and then we have a summer home in Delaware on the ocean where I have a little office. And at each desk, there's a picture of Thomas More. So I write everything I write, his picture is looking up at me.
Hmm. Did you find any solace from Thomas More during all of this, during really the public trial you went through, starting in July of 2003, with a run-of-the-mill article you wrote, a little column you wrote that you turned in three a week
yeah.
on Valerie Plame, mentioning this woman who was a CIA operative in passing.
In passing. The only reason I mentioned her was how in the world did Joe Wilson, who was a Clinton staffer, didn't know anything about intelligence, didn't know anything about weapons of mass destruction, why was he sent on this mission where he didn't even come back with a conclusive report? Mm-hmm. And the answer was that his wife works at the CIA and she suggested it. So it was a little twist of the kind of little inside dope I like to write about. And it took a long time for people to get excited, but the critics of President Bush thought that this was a wedge to really get after him. And the answer to your question, yes, Thomas More and my faith was a solace to me. And I really felt that a lot of people turned against me. I must say that the Chicago Sun-Times was always, my home paper was always supportive. Washington Post was wonderfully supportive of me. They run my column for all the years I've written it. But a lot of people, a lot of my comrades, brothers and sisters in journalism, turned against me on this for no reason, because this story was blown way, way out of proportion, as if there was some plot to do with him. I just got to say one thing, and sure. that is that the person who leaked her name to me, or told me her name, was the Deputy Secretary of State, Richard Armitage, who was very critical of the war. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I was very critical of war. I was opposed to the invasion of Iraq. So the idea that this was some plot to justify the war was ridiculous.
Why do you think Armitage leaked the name to you?
I think he's a gossip. Mm-hmm. And he saw it in a paper. They were trying to explain to themselves why in the world Joe Wilson was, and they put this out, and he told me that, and he looked in my eyes. I saw it, but that was a funny thing. He said, and he said, I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, "That's really Evans and Novak, isn't it?" And mm-hmm. the kind of little gossipy items that we had trafficked in for so many years.
Now, some said, and they continue to say, you endangered Valerie Plame's missions abroad. She was a CIA operative, and therefore you endangered government agents in the field.
She had not been in the field for many, many years. She had, my information is, she had been outed by the traitor Aldrich Ames, a Soviet agent. There was no plans to send her abroad as an agent, and I talked to the CIA, of course, about this mm-hmm. to confirm that she worked there, and they didn't want me to use her name. They don't want you to use anything. But all they had to do was say, this is going to endanger her life. It's going to endanger our operations, and I wouldn't have written it. And if they had any doubt about it, I was in contact with George Tenet, then the director of Central Intelligence. Mm-hmm. All they had to do was put him on the phone and have him tell me that. But nobody told me that.
Do you consider yourself an advocate journalist? That name, that moniker now seems to be bandied about a lot, not necessarily in relation to you, but many are describing themselves as such.
I am not, because I don't go out and say we shouldn't invade Iraq. I never wrote that column. Mm-hmm. I did kind of say it on television that was wrong because it was a different form of on the Capitol Den,
right.
Yes. But that isn't the kind of combat. I do write information indicating there was no weapons of mass destruction, indicating the trouble that lie ahead. So I have a point of view based on factual reporting, but I am I don't think that people, when they read Robert Novak in the morning in the newspaper, want to be told what to think. They want to get some new facts.
Hmm. Let's talk for a moment about the great, I mean, you have known every president really since Truman. I'm going to mention their names, and I want you to give me kind of a snapshot of your impressions of these men and your personal dealings. Lyndon Baines Johnson.
A manipulative, a masterful legislative leader, was able to count heads. He tried to count supporters in the millions when he was president. That didn't work so well. I thought he was a poor president and certainly a very bad war president.
But you wrote a very fair and well-reviewed book, The Exercise of Power, on that
yes.
President, you and Raleigh.
But the greatest praise for him came in the first half of the book when he was majority leader.
Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan.
The only fundamentally successful president in my 50 years in Washington, because he knew that the presidency was not a management job, it was a leadership job. He was there to inspire people. He also was there for very limited goals. He wasn't a micromanager as Johnson was, who tried to run the whole government, every little thing. And Reagan wanted to regenerate the economy, win the Cold War, and revive the spirit of the American people, who did all three.
Jimmy Carter.
Maybe the worst president in my time.
Why do you say that?
Because I think he was a liar. I think he was an incompetent. He lied to me, lied to the American people. He was the worst party leader we had. The Democratic Party was very split under him. They hated his presidency. And I think that's one of the functions of a president. He must be a party leader.
George Bush Sr. and George W.
I think they were mediocre. I think they were mediocre presidents. I think they were really old-fashioned liberal Republicans hiding under a conservative cloak who really liked big government, a lot of use of government. And also, I do believe, particularly George W. Bush, has the belief that the use of American force can spread democracy around the world in the manner of Woodrow Wilson. And I think that is an illusion fraught with danger.
President Richard Nixon.
I thought he was a bad man and a bad president. I think he was a cheat, a manipulator. I think he was not a conservative. The government that was built up openly under Johnson was encouraged in stealth by him. I thought the Watergate scandal was hurt the country, conservatism, and the Republican Party for years to come.
May Bob Novak rest in peace. And it has been 7 years, which I can't believe, since we lost a member of Hollywood royalty, a director, actor, Jerry Lewis. I sat down recently with his son to discuss his father's charitable work and a terrific new book he's written about his dad called Jerry Lewis on Being a Person. Here's my interview with Chris Lewis. He grew up among Hollywood royalty as the son of late and legendary comic actor-director Jerry Lewis. He worked with his dad on every muscular dystrophy telethon for nearly 40 years, and beginning in the year 2000, he followed a charitable vocation of his own, bringing the gift of mobility to the disabled as president of the American Wheelchair Mission. He's here tonight to talk about his charity work and a brand new book he's written about his dad. It's called Jerry Lewis on Being a Person. Please welcome back to the program my pal Chris Lewis. Chris,
thank you, Raymond.
Thank you for coming. I saw this in its early iteration,
yes.
And I loved this book for so many reasons. My question is, tell us about, this is kind of the framework you're using here, is based on a book that your father wrote,
yes.
At one point, a very small book by his own admission, called On Being a Person. How did that book come to be, and why did you use that as the rubric for this work?
Well, during the filming of his film, The Nutty Professor, in 1962, he kind of felt there was some tension between the crew, like they weren't getting along real well in the first week. So he went home that night, and he wrote on his typewriter 45 different things that you should do to be a better person, like love God, pray, buy a dog, give candy to children, you know, things
like
that.
Tell the truth.
Just, yeah, stuff. Say good morning to anybody. And what I did is I realized that I was following many of the things I learned in his book through my life. And so then I started investigating, well, why were those things important to him? Mm-hmm. And I believe I have created a framework to be able to explain how he became such an incredibly successful entertainer, comedian, writer, director, and one of the most impactful humanitarians in history.
Yet for all of, look, there have been volumes written about your father, thousands of articles and interviews. I mean, I read a lot of them before the interviews we did. Yeah. Yet you say here that he's misunderstood. What about him is misunderstood?
Well, people took him as being either overconfident or an egomaniac, but he was a perfectionist. Mm-hmm. That's all he wanted. He wanted everybody to put in as much as he did into being the best person he could possibly be for everyone.
But, you know, I'm going to jump ahead because there's a line in the book that you found, I guess, written out, and I don't know if this was in a diary or something that was just top of mind that he felt he had to get out. But I'm going to put it on the screen. He says, "The pain of perfection is a constant reminder that what we do is more than just a whim or a normal gesture. What we do is meant to represent so much that we have to be imprisoned by our own government and pay attention to the rules and regulations set down by that government. A government that functions from within and one that we are not able to confer with or reason with or doubt or deny. For us to lose the pain, we would have to give up our very existence and hurry back to the masses and be one of the many. One of those timid souls that really don't care or believe that ecstasy is even attainable. How sad that would be, and what pain of sadness, and that pain of sadness is probably far greater than the pain of perfection." Why does that capture who he is, and where did you find that?
I actually found that in many of the documents that he gave to me. He would write these things out just for himself. It wasn't meant to go to anybody. It was just for himself, because he was feeling the pain of perfection. In the late 60s when he wrote this, it was a very frustrating time in the movie business, and he was not able to be as creative as he wanted to be. He didn't have the latitude he had before, and it was a very frustrating time for him.
You know, I mean, we have to say, your father was a remarkable artist in so many ways, an innovator. I mean, you know, I remember reading here, he talks about having Cinderfella, one of his famous films, that was already in the can. Paramount wanted a summer release from Jerry, and he didn't have it. But he was booked at the Fontainebleau at that time in Miami, performing. What happened?
In the 3 weeks that he was at the Fontainebleau, he shot The Bellboy. That was his first film as a director. He spent 2 months writing the script.
Oh my God.
He conferred with his good friend Stan Laurel to help him with the outline of his first script. He then brought the film crew from Paramount, went to the Fontainebleau, shot the film in 27 days. I remember being on the set. It was bedlam, but it was so much fun. And he performed every night in the show.
Well, you had a shot list here that you have actually a photograph of. Mm-hmm. I was stunned. 20 setups today. 11 setups. Who does that?
That's
20 setups. A setup is an entirely different lighting scheme, a scene. 20 a day?
Mm-hmm.
How did he pull this off?
He's a crazy person.
That helped, right? Tell me about the influence of Stan Laurel. You mentioned him a moment ago. You even refer to him as Uncle Stan in here.
Yes. He became a dear friend of my dad's in the late 1950s and was there to guide him along in his creative process. And I remember him as a wonderful man who we knew as Uncle Stan.
34 successful films in a row for Paramount, which I think is a record.
I think so.
I mean, that's an incredible, to have hit after hit like that, really, from the 50s into the 60s is simply remarkable. And he was churning out multiple films a year, many of his own design. Does it irritate you that we don't hear more about the legacy of Jerry Lewis? As a comic innovator, the man who created Video Assist and these brilliant sight gags.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little frustrating, but there are constantly new generations that are discovering his work. We've worked closely with Paramount for years on getting the films out there, and they're on almost all the digital platforms now. And Paramount's come around in quite a few different ways in the last few years, and they're much more available now than they were digitally.
Now, this book, we should tell people what this is. Yes, it is kind of Jerry's philosophy on, quote, being a person, but it's also very personal, warm, and I would say newsy remembrances of your dad. You really had a front row seat, not only through your childhood, but you toured with him. You were his road manager, his stage manager, which I'll get to in a minute. But give me a sense. What struck me most as I reread the book, there's a chapter on prayer. There's a chapter on the love of God. Tell me about how your mother's faith, Patty's faith, shaped not only your whole family, but your father, who was Jewish, his faith.
Very much so. My mom's faith was his guiding light because she was his rock. No matter where he went, in what direction, she was the rock he always came back to. And my mom said he put the first crucifix up in our house before I was born. She said, I never hung one because I thought maybe he wouldn't like it. She says, he put one up for me. And so his prayer was very important to him. He talks about it in many documents that I have, and I remember him throughout my life talking about how important it was to pray.
We have images here of Dean Martin and your dad. Obviously, the partnership that defined both of their careers in many ways certainly started it. Give me a sense of, in the book, you suggest that Dean was the man Jerry always wanted to be. Why?
Because Dean had so much stage presence and was so suave and never nervous.
Laid back. I mean, he almost was careless at times. I mean,
completely. That's the way it appeared. Yeah. But my dad would be in the dressing room an hour and a half before performance with butterflies in his stomach, you know, just nervous because he's got to go on stage. Dean would come down from the suite, check his hair in a mirror, and walk on stage. He didn't need to worry about it. So my dad was in awe of that.
But that yin and yang is what made the act. I mean, as you watch it, when you watch them at the Copacabana, that black and white footage, or you watch one of the movies, it's the coolness of Dean offset by the manic madness of Jerry that makes it all crackle. I mean, it makes it work.
Absolutely.
But it is interesting, and I want to get back to that relationship in a minute, but I asked your dad, as you remember, why he undertook helming the MDA telethon, and we should tell people, you know this more than anybody, he not only gave 60 years of his life to this cause, it was his everyday obsession. He was writing letters, he was doing personal appearances, he was raising money long before the telethon actually started, those crazed three days of production. Here's what the exchange I had with Jerry Lewis. Watch this.
Muscular Dystrophy Association, you and Dean did really one of the first telethons at Carnegie Hall.
Right.
Live in New York. Oh, yeah, and then years later, you take this on, this incredible broadcast. 45 years, you raised $2.6 billion.
61 years.
Total.
$2,500,000.
Why did you do it for so long, Jerry?
Because I kept getting the money.
What's the full story here, Chris? He met a family very early on.
He met a family in 1949. I was able to trace it back through my mom's diaries and his performance record diaries of where he was when, at the Copacabana, May 8th of 1949, when his cousin, Louis Katz, was involved in the 24th annual fundraiser for the Jewish Sanitarium Hospital for Children with Chronic Diseases. And my dad went to meet him at the Waldorf that day before performances and met this family, who had lost two children to muscular dystrophy and were waiting for the third to die.
And that really was, that was the inspiration for this lifelong support of MDA.
My mom told me that he met a family and they touched him so deeply that he came home in tears and said, we have to help them. And that's what launched it.
The amazing, and we'll never see, I mean, he said it during, when I interviewed him, you were there. No one will ever top his record. And The what happened there was not only did you have a performer who was so moved by the cause, but he was able to bring out the biggest stars in music, comedy, Hollywood, every discipline to come and do this beautiful love-a-thon for the whole country. There's no one who could summon and do that today. There just isn't that magnitude of star.
No. And there were 213 television stations carrying the telethon. That's why he called it the Love Network.
Amazing.
Because we were touching so many people in so many places.
You were your dad's road manager, lighting manager, prop manager from 87 to 89. When he was performing at Bally's with his friend Sammy Davis Jr.,
yes.
I was privileged to have been there one of those nights, and it was, they were incredible. I mean, they were both incredible. Tell me how that performance and that time that they were at Bally's actually was the rekindling of the relationship between your dad and Dean Martin, which
yes.
is something I'd never heard before.
Yes, they performed 12 times at Bally's between that approximately two-year period of time. And the stage manager told me, he said, yeah, that's the mirror that Dean checks his hair in when he comes downstairs from the suite before he walks on stage. And so I was on the stage with my dad one night checking the props on the piano, and I pointed it out to him. I said, you know, that's the mirror Dean checks his hair in. And he comes in like a week after we leave. If you wrote a note on it with a Sharpie, he'd see it. And he goes, that's a good idea. And so he wrote a note on it that says, hi, Paul, which is what he always called Dean, love JL.
Oh.
And when he came back at the next engagement, there was no answer. And so he wrote underneath it, ditto, love JL. And the next time it said, the name's Dino, not ditto, schmuck, love partner. So that's how the rekindling started. And every time they would alternate performing at Bally's, they would write a note to each other on the mirrors, and there ended up being like 8 or 9 mirrors in that little room.
Do you have the mirrors?
I don't. But
oh.
But the stage manager told me that before he left Bally's, before they changed the stage, he took them.
Oh.
So I'm hoping, his name was Pat, I don't remember his last name, but I'm hoping Pat still
You got to get
them.
Those
they
mirrors. Those
them,
are
you know.
Those are some precious mirrors.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to share this with the audience. When I asked Jerry Lewis what his legacy would be, this is what he told me. Watch. What is the legacy of Jerry Lewis?
The legacy?
The legacy of Jerry Lewis.
My son. That's the greatest legacy that I've left this world. That son.
Chris Lewis, how will you continue to extend and honor the legacy of your dad, Joseph Levitch?
Well, it's quite an honor, and I'm enjoying doing it by what we're doing with the book, sharing the true stories about my dad and his love of humanity and his love of God and how prayer was such an important part of his life. And we're doing those things in a number of ways. And there's some projects we're working on, documentaries and things like that, that you're going to be seeing a lot more.
Good. We need to see more of Jerry. We need his laughter and his love. And he so touched my life and our viewers in an incredible way. And it was such a gift to know him. And I thank you for bringing us together and making that happen. It was one of my favorite interviews, I have to tell you. And that's with popes and presidents. And it's right up there.
That's great.
So, God bless you. Thank you. Chris
thank
Lewis,
you.
Thank you for being here. Jerry Lewis, On Being a Person by his son Chris Lewis is available at bookstores everywhere and online. But go to JerryLewis2024.com. JerryLewis2024.com. You can order the book directly there. And for more information on the great work Chris does at the American Wheelchair Mission, visit amwheelchair.org. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Ron.
I miss Jerry so much. Jerry Lewis, On Being a Person by Chris Lewis, is available at bookstores everywhere and online. That is all the time we have for now. But be sure to join us next week for an exclusive interview with the star of the new biopic, Reagan. Dennis Quaid joins us for a probing interview. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thanks for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.